Hi, everyone. I'm Julia.
And I'm Ranjana. We're part of the CAP Foundation team. And this year, our focus is on connection.
Connection between patients and pathologists, between innovation and access.
Every gift to the CAP Foundation helps strengthen those connections.
That support shows up in programs like See, Test, and Treat here in the U.S. and in global grants that bring critical diagnostics to places where resources are limited.
So when you give, you're not just supporting a program. You're helping build a stronger, more connected community.
It's easy to be part of that impact. Check the show notes or visit foundation.cap.org to donate.
Hey guys, welcome back to Beyond the Test, Connecting Communities Through Pathology, a podcast from the CAP Foundation. Today we're kicking off part two of a two-part series exploring pathologist burnout. In the last episode, you heard from Dr. Julia Keith, examining the human, structural, and cultural dimensions of burnout and what departments can do to build real evidence-based wellness infrastructure. Let's welcome back Executive Director Maya to lead us through today's discussion. Maya?
Thanks, Joanna. On this episode, we explore what burnout looks like across borders and what happens when the challenge isn't just workload, but scarcity. Our guest, Dr. Dan Milner, shares powerful insights into the realities faced by pathologists working in low and middle income countries, where electricity, reagents, and basic laboratory supplies can never be taken for granted. This discussion goes far beyond exhaustion. It touches on sustainability, advocacy, global partnerships, and the future of pathology in a digitally connected world. Because beyond every test, there is not only a patient, there is a system, a community, and a story shaping the diagnosis.
Hi, Dr. Milner. How are you?
Good morning, Maya. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. We'll just jump right into the questions, and we're looking forward to getting your perspective on things. So I know you've worked in environments where basic necessities like reagents, electricity are often luxuries. How does the burnout of scarcity experienced by those pathologists in low resource settings compare to burnout in high volume U.S. labs?
Yeah, great question. So just for people's understanding, when we see a pathology laboratory in a low middle income country, they come in several flavors. They can be a government laboratory that has a very small budget and experiences scarcity and stockouts almost constantly as like a way of life. It's just constant. There can be private laboratories which obviously have money coming in from patients and the ability to buy reagents and good customer relations with their vendors. And they don't typically have stockouts, but they still do experience them. But they, in general, can prevent that because they have the funds to avoid that. And then you've got somewhere in the middle where you might have a public-private partnership, or you might have a hybrid government academic laboratory based with a U.S. or European-based institution, for example, that will also experience stockouts, but has a little bit more control over them, although things like government regulation and customs importation, et cetera, can get in the way. Whereas private labs seem to be able to get around that quite often and have rare stockouts. So when we think about those three kinds of groups, for the first group, if they're raised in that system, right, if they are trained as a medical student, trained as a resident in that system of constant stockouts, et cetera, it just becomes an expectation that they may go weeks to months without actually having the materials they need to do their work. And, you know, in my experience, people in low resource settings are extremely resourceful. And so they may revert to doing more cytology rather than doing histology because they can do FNAs and read them. They may have a private lab that's outside of their public lab job, and they use supplies and reagents from the private lab to support the public lab in periods of scarcity. Or they, because they don't have much to do and they're a physician and they're well respected because they're probably one of the only few pathologists that are there. And they're often younger, especially if they've just finished training, they get called upon to do other government service, be parts of the Ministry of Health, be leads for national programs, which takes them away from the bench, takes them away from the lab. And although it's a positive experience for them, it isn't so helpful for patients. So that's where we see a lot of the challenges of resources not being there is that people can adapt to them, but what can happen, and this is where it gets to the burnout issue, is that people just get frustrated with it being that way, and they'll just go get a private practice job somewhere, or they'll move to another country that's paying better in order to do that. The upper group, the private practice group, they have supply demand, they have cash, they can get the vendors to respond. So outside of disasters such as COVID, for example, or a tsunami or some sort of government control issue, shakeup, or a coup or something, they can usually get that. And so we don't see them burning out so much related to that issue. They typically tend to do okay. Where they may have trouble is if they are in private, but they're also running a government lab, and that can work weaken them a little bit. And then for that hybrid version, they tend to be, their goal tends to be to train people, educate people, to offer them opportunities. And so pathologists or doctors or nurses that are in a program that's affiliated with an academic or some other public-private partnership often are being promoted and get opportunities to travel abroad and work, et cetera. So you often don't lose them so much to burnout as you do to just success. And they leave the program and then you have to train new people, but that's fine. That's okay. But it's rare that someone in one of those programs would leave because there's good funding, there's great resources, there's really smart people from other countries that are working with them. They're often really smart people. That's why they were recruited to work for that local institution. And so it's very productive for them academically. So I would say that's pretty uncommon for people to leave that. Unless, of course, there is a major shakeup with funding. And so suddenly there's no funding left, then obviously they're going to move on to something else. And then when we compare that with US-based burnout, I think US-based burnout is obviously not related to scarcity so much as it is related to the reality or the perception that someone is being overworked. And I say it like that way not to be disrespectful or condescending to any pathologist practicing anywhere in the world, but there are benchmarks for how productive a pathologist could be or should be. And those benchmarks, for example, let's just take the hypothetical example, 30 to 40 cases a day or 300 to 400 cases per month, that they're on service, that in some settings, that's like, oh my gosh, I do twice that in a week. And other settings, it's like, oh my gosh, that's three times as much as I do now. That would overwhelm me. And in those, both of those groups may have really legitimate reasons for working harder or not being able to do as much. But we have to be very conscious of what our pathologists are doing, what they're being asked to do away from the microscope, what they can physically accomplish in a day based on the complexity of the cases, et cetera, before we pass judgment on their productivity. And so I think that's a really challenging role. I think Canada has done a really great job of creating systems where they can document exactly how much work it takes a pathologist to do a certain kind of case, and then they allocate work to them based on that, and then hire new people as they need them to make sure that those numbers are staying there. In the US, most pathologists are in an eat what you kill situation, right? So every sign out they do, they get paid for, especially in private practice, not so much in academia, but usually they're well compensated. When you go to government facilities in the US, it's more, it's no longer the Starbucks, it's more like the DMV, and people show up and they do the work that's in front of them for the pay that they're getting. But if you ask them to do more work, why wouldn't they complain? Because that's what they're used to, that's their status quo. So you have to be really careful and respectful of people, because these are physicians, these are very smart people that are working really hard, in their mind, and it may be that they could push out a little bit more productivity, or it may be that AI tools or digital pathology could help them become more productive. But you have to be conscious that they may have many things pulling them away from the microscope.
So kind of focusing on low to middle income countries only, it sounds like while very resourceful in all three of the categories that you explained, there is a level of exhaustion that can enter in all three. So even in the high performing, the one where you said, you know, there is funding, they have the ability to travel, their exhaustion can also enter because of a lack of funding, of changing of positions. So what is the solution for exhaustion in the low to middle income countries where the resources are limited? So there may not be the possibility of hiring additional. Is there a solution for that?
Right. It's a great question as well. So, I think when you look at a low middle income country government hospital, right, there are some advocacy projects that we could do that ultimately would result in more resources for the department. But that kind of advocacy work is very challenging. When we think, let's just say, take for example, a hospital where they have only one pathologist and they have, you know, 20,000 cases a year. That's probably a non-tenable situation, right? You need at least one pathologist per 10,000 cases, depending on the complexity, sometimes one per 5,000. So having one pathologist with 20,000 cases, we know they're going to have terrible turnaround time. Even if they have all the resources they need, they're not going to be able to get that work done. So that's when it's important to have a conversation with the employer, right? Ministry of Health, whoever it is, to say there's a bare minimum number of pathologists that you need to be able to run a department, and they're in an academic center, for example, or they're in a government facility where they have lots of other responsibilities. We have to take that into account and say we really need four, right, not one, for this 20,000 per year service. And so how can we work towards hiring three more pathologists, right? So now let's say we solve that. We get four pathologists. There's still only 20,000 cases a year. They're each responsible for 5,000. But every 2 weeks, they can't run the lab because there's no electricity or there's no water or whatever. So you have to think critically about why those shortages are happening, right? So with water, you can have rooftop storage tanks that hold 1,000 gallons of water that can get you through a week without water. You can have solar panels. There's a lot of sun in Africa. You know, might as well use it. So you could put solar panels on the roof and have plenty of electricity. Those are relatively inexpensive. But if you need to have it overnight, you need batteries, and those are kind of pricey. But again, there are efforts in social impact investing to produce low-cost batteries for solar for that exact reason. So now let's say we have plenty of water, we have plenty of electricity because we've done solar, we've done that, and we have enough staff. But now we need really complicated, complex reagents that you can't just go pick up at the corner grocery, right? And this is the major problem with these facilities and stockouts, is it's not a stockout of alcohol, right? They can get alcohol, they can get formalin, they can get xylene even. I mean, they can make an H&E slide for the most part. What they stock out of are reagents for immunohistochemistry, reagents for special stains, which, as you know, in some diseases are crucial for being able to even make a diagnosis, right? Breast cancer, you wouldn't even move a muscle without ERP or HER2-Ki67 to direct you through immunohistochemistry to how that patient should be treated. So, you know, that's where we have a lot of stress put on those types of facilities, because they don't have the answer. They can't give a complete answer, and it's out of their control, right? Because they don't have the reagents. And this is true, you know, in all three of the scenarios I described. If they don't have, you know, an antibody or a developing solution or one of the other things, if it just doesn't get put in the box when it's shipped from Germany or the US or wherever it's coming from, they're stuck because they can't do the assay without it, right? And so that underlies a fundamental problem of pathology, which is that we're far too dependent on immunohistochemistry. And when we look at things like digital pathology and marker prediction based on histology using AI tools, those could be solutions that could really catapult and leapfrog Africa and other low middle income countries to a new position, because we don't need immunohistochemistry if we have those tools. And so I can give you a brief example. I won't mention product names, but there is an RT-PCR for ERP or HER2-Ki67 that only takes about 2 hours to do. And you can do it on formalin fixed paraffin embedded tissue or on a fresh FNA. And it gives you ERP or HER2-Ki67 equivalent to immunohistochemistry. And it can be run by a high school student. So now you're going from, you know, 48 hours of work and $75 to $100 worth of reagents and the potential to stock out to a single device that you load with a sample that takes a few minutes to prepare by a high school student and then 2 hours to run, and then you have your answer. So that we can't do that for every cancer, we can't do that for every marker, but that's an example of how you can leapfrog that to do that. And I am part of a foundation that's actively trying to deploy that particular technology to multiple countries for breast cancer.
That's actually, so I kind of feel like my next question might even be a little insensitive because of what you're just describing, that these are, that the scenario for pathologists is much different for those in low to middle income countries. So where I'm going with this is the foundation recently did a survey of pathologists that participated in our See, Test, and Treat program. See, Test, and Treat is a pathologist-led free cancer screening program. And what we found in the survey from those in the U.S. that answered said that participating in a program like this helped them find their why. But I think you just very plainly articulated that it's not the why that's causing burnout for pathologists in low to middle income countries, which makes it very distinct from the U.S. or even Canada. It's the resources, the lack of resources, and then maybe even the lack of funding support for additional resources. So I'd love to hear, if you don't mind, just a little more about the foundation that you have that you support that is providing resources.
Sure. So I work with several different foundation groups. I'm currently chair of pathology at Olive View Medical Center in UCLA in California, which is a county safety net hospital. So it's about as close to global health as you can get in Los Angeles, which is why I took the position. It's very exciting for me. But on the outside of that, I do volunteer with a couple of foundations, one of which is the Max Foundation based in Seattle, Washington. And they've been providing for nearly 30 years treatment for patients who have confirmed chronic myelogenous leukemia. They did that. They have hundreds of countries and, you know, 100 and something countries involved, thousands of patients that they treat every day, but they wanted to do more. And so I want to say a couple of years ago, they decided to go into breast cancer, very specifically for metastatic breast cancer in women who are ER positive, HER2 negative, because there happen to be a class of drugs, CDK4/6 inhibitors, that are very effective in prolonging life in those patients, but they're often not available in low middle income countries. And even in the US, they're extremely expensive. We needed to be able to recruit those patients. And so we needed an ERPR, we needed an ER and a HER2 status on them in order to put them in the program. And so in hospitals that have immunohistochemistry, there's not a problem, but not every hospital has immunohistochemistry. And then even within the hospitals with immunohistochemistry, if it's a private hospital, which is often the case of who we partner with because of the need to be able to guarantee supply chain, patients who can't afford it, can't pay for the immunohistochemistry, might be left out. And so this assay that I was describing is very low cost and basically can be given away for free to those patients so that patients that don't have enough money to have the test can have the test done through this test, and then they can get the medication for free through the Max Foundation. It's not available in all countries. So even though they're in 100 plus countries for CML, they're only in a handful of countries for breast cancer, because it is very different rolling out breast cancer treatment mm-hmm. than it is for CML. Because, you know, as our listeners will know, CML is kind of a medical student diagnosis that you can make with a slide under a microscope. We do require that they are confirmed to be Philadelphia chromosome positive using a BCR ABLE test. But again, that's the same cartridgey kind of company thing that we use for breast, which is very easy to do. But that's it. And then they get treated. But in breast cancer, you know, you got to have a biopsy, you got to have staging, you got to have all this information, which you can't just do with one person. So it's a little bit more complicated, but they're still doing it, right? They're still rolling it out and doing that. I also work with Partners in Health, which is based in a dozen plus countries, and I support the pathology for their cancer programs. That's everything I just described before is what we deal with. They're one of the academic private practice kind of public partnership approaches, but all around them are the other two systems, the private and the government. And so they work with all of them to do that. So we are constantly exchanging information and helping these labs figure out how to do that in a given country. But, you know, unfortunately, the only impact that can have is in places where we're working. So in places where we're not working, I can predict what it's going to look like, but it's hard to implement solutions without a set of partners to do that. And I mean clinical partners, other pathology partners, other medical partners. You can't do it alone in cancer. It takes a village, honestly. And I come from malaria, right? So for me, for malaria, I can take two college students, fill one's backpack with a rapid diagnostic test for malaria, fill the other one's backpack with artemisinin therapy, and send them to any village in Africa, and mortality for malaria will go to zero overnight. As soon as they have a fever, you test them. If they're positive, you treat them. Nobody gets cerebral malaria. Nobody gets severe malarial anemia. Everyone survives, right? And so that's why I left malaria, in fact, is because I'm like, there's a solution. It's low cost. It's easy. We should just be doing that everywhere. And yet people still want to invest billions of dollars in, you know, surveillance technologies for gametocytes, which is interesting. I think it's really fascinating, but we wouldn't need to do that if we just treated everybody that had a fever. And we still unfortunately don't do that. But in cancer, if you want to do the same thing, you would need a couple of semi trucks to drive into each village. And that's not really feasible. So we have to think about different solutions.
That's a really great segue into a question that I didn't even prep you for. So I apologize. But what can medical societies do? What should they be doing?
Yeah, I think, you know, there again a couple of approaches they can take. It is a time commitment from a foundation or a medical society to be involved, and it's also something that they should not take, you know, tread on lightly, right? They either need to commit to it fully or just stay out of it, right? Because it takes a lot. Because there is 1,000 times the need of what you would be able to provide. And that's the ultimate challenge. So how do you allocate or parse out what little help you can give to who? And for me, the groups I've already always worked with, which include CAP, USCP, and ASCP, for example, it's always been focused projects, right? So it's either we want to do one thing in every country, or we want to do a lot of things in one country, right? Or we want to focus on one aspect like education and deliver that everywhere. And I think that those are all valid approaches, but it really depends on funding. So let's say, you know, hypothetically, CAP had an angel donor give them $20 million and say, this is for your global health efforts. Then CAP would invest that money, figure out what their return is going to be, and then give out grants. And, you know, 99% of that money is grants every year, and have an application process for pathologists in low middle income countries to apply with like intelligent projects. And this is what will help. And then go from there. And that would make a huge impact, right? And I know it would, because we did it. We did it with a group called Sergo, where we gave out $50,000 to $75,000 grants, and they were incredibly successful and led to more projects and more things that people were doing. We did it with ASCP by implementing a telepathology in multiple places. And then CAP has done it with the C test treat program. You know, so I think that it's you have to tie what impact is possible to the resources that you have, especially the sustained resources that you have. If you have a one-time thing where someone's like, oh, I want to give you $1 million, do something with it in global health, that's great. But what you should do is donate it to another society that's doing a long-term project, right? But if you've got $20 million that you can sit on in the bank and have an investment from that you can do grants every year, now you can have a program that can grow. And as you're successful, you can acquire more cash into that fund to ultimately be able to do, you know, to do more and more good as you go along.
That's an excellent point. So the foundation does have, the CAP Foundation does have a global pathology fund, and we do award out grants for development grants for research. And then we do education grants to gain access to CAP education. But I think you said something that deserves repeating, is that it can't be just kind of one-off project and then you're done. It has to be an investment year over year. And so those funds that you might have gotten $1 million for, those need to grow. Because what I've seen, especially in the applications that we've received from folks in low to middle income countries, is that $10,000, $5,000 is a penny. It's nothing compared to the actual amount of investment that's needed in those countries.
No, that's right. But I think that whereas the lower limit that you're describing is true, it's that's not going to do much to move the needle, although every bit helps. The nice thing in pathology is the upper end isn't that much. You know, you can invest, $300,000 in a site that has a pathologist but no lab. And at the end of that investment, they'll have a fully functioning lab. They have their SOPs. They can have trained staff, et cetera. And now all they need is an ongoing budget to buy reagents and supplies, right? So the capital investment for pathology to start a lab is really low. And many of these places have a lab. They might need a couple of pieces of updated equipment or a better service contract, but they're not, you know, very few places are starting from scratch. But even if they are starting from scratch, the capital investment is really low. The cost is the ongoing running of the lab, right? And especially if you're doing immunohistochemistry, you're talking about 3/4 of your budget is immunohistochemistry. So a lab that does, let's say, 10,000 samples a year is going to have a budget of about, gosh, I have to think, 1.5 million or no, 1 million in reagents and supplies, three quarters of which is going to be for immunohistochemistry in a general setting. That's just a general hypothetical setting. So where does that come from? Well, if the government is a partner in this investment, so if the government says, hey, CAP, hey, whoever, whatever foundation is there, we appreciate you're going to dump $2 million into our country to build 5 new pathology laboratories, which is very feasible to do that. And we're going to support each of those laboratories with, you know, $500,000 a year operating budget so that they can run, right? That's fine. That would work perfectly. But what you have to remember is that many of our colleagues in low middle income countries, because of what happened with malaria, HIV, tuberculosis, et cetera, have become addicted to aid, foreign aid, financial aid. And, you know, I was told a story, I won't recount any names, but I was told a story by a pretty famous oncologist who went to Uganda to talk to the president of Uganda about him investing more in cancer in his country, meaning I need you to carve money out of your existing budget and put it towards cancer. And he looked at him and he said, I don't understand what you think you're talking to me about, because last week, Bill Gates and Bill Clinton were in my office handing me $200 million to deal with HIV/AIDS. So we can't, you know, oncology can't compete with that until we have billions and billions of dollars to be able to throw at countries to deal with oncology. You're not going to move the needle in that traditional system. So you have to approach it differently, right? You have to approach it from the point of view of like patient advocacy, where patients are demanding change, because that's why HIV treatment was made available in Africa. Not because, you know, we can talk about PEPFAR, which is great and it's been one of probably the best things for HIV ever, but that was because people in Africa were demanding treatment, and George Bush could no longer ignore it, right? And he had to do something. And so if you have strong advocates for cancer, then they will demand pathology services, they'll demand diagnostic services, and then the government has to respond, right? Because, you know, it's just a natural thing. The challenge though, is that HIV affected everybody, right? Because anybody could get it, right? Cancer only affects 5% of people, right? And so that's another part of our problem in pathology, is that what we're really good at diagnosing cancer, and it takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of time, it's the tip of the iceberg for all the disease out there in patient populations. And so we have to be very thoughtful of that when we're asking people to spend money on it. And this is why people are like, oh, well, prevention is the most important thing, because if you just prevent cancer, don't get it. Yeah, but prevention is only 30% of cancers, right? If prevention worked perfectly, which it never does, we'd still have 70% of the cancers that we have, right? So that's great, but that's not the solution. It can't just be prevention. You have to have more than that.
I do want to see if there is any tie-in to this idea that if pathologists can understand their why, they feel less burnout or less exhausted. Is there any connection at all between that sort of theory and what happens in low to middle income countries?
Yeah, so there are, but there are, you know, I would say there are as many attitudes and approaches to pathology as there are pathologists, right? Everybody is different. Everyone is unique. And older generation pathologists versus younger pathologists have completely different motivations for why they do things, right? We know that any pathologist who's under the age of 40 likely grew up influenced by global health being an important thing in their life, and social connectivity and caring about people they've never met before, reaching out to the other and supporting them, even though you you don't have any reason to do that. Pathologists that are over 40 were raised completely different, right? They were, you know, including me, were like, you go to work, you do your job, you do your job because you're good at your job, you have a job because if you don't have a job, you're not productive to society, right? It's a completely different attitude in younger people, which is fine. Like, I mean, I don't have a problem with it, but it's just a different sort of attitude. So when you take one of these pathologists that's over 40, and I'm dating myself, but it may be over 45 now, but when you take a pathologist that's over 40 and they go to Africa or they go to South America and they work in a pathology lab there, it absolutely influences them. They will either start donating money or resources or more of their time to it, or they'll encourage other people to go to the same place they went to. They'll write a blog about it. They'll do something because it strongly influences them. Now, if they go and they come back and it doesn't affect them at all, they probably shouldn't have gone in the first place. And that's really just medical tourism, right? And that's not really helpful. But when someone goes and they're really engaged in a meaningful project and they can see how their hands being there are changing patients' outcomes and lives, which is very easy to do in a low middle income country in Africa, then they get very inspired and they often want to do things. Now, they get inspired and they want to do things, but they're not going to like drop everything and move to Africa. People that are under 40, right, that are pathologists could go to Africa, have that same experience, and then suddenly say, I want to work here for the rest of my life. Right. And I want my academic center to figure out how to pay me to be here. And again, because whereas the people over 40 are in this sort of like loyal to their job, loyal to their institution, it's really good to have the job, you know, kind of thing. People that are under that are more like they're loyal to themselves and their principles, which is fine. I'm not negating it. It's just an observation. And so because they're loyal to themselves and their principles, what they think is important is what they think everyone else should think is important. And if it's their career, they may want their academic job to be 6 months in Africa, 6 months in the US, right? Now, I happen to have worked with a woman who is, I won't say significantly older than me. She's older than me by about 20 years, who did that her whole career. She spent 6 months in Africa and 6 months in the US, right? So was she rare? Kind of, but there were other people in her generation that would even spend moved full time to Africa and work, or would do periods of time like that. But they did it at a point where there was nothing, like there were no resources, and it was before HIV, right? So they were going in and working on diseases and with resources that were available. Then once HIV, malaria, TB, kind of the money exploded for those, many people wanted to go to Africa for 6 months or a year or whatever, or low middle income countries and do that. So I think there's definitely been ups and downs. And what we went through about 10 years ago, maybe 15 to 10 years ago, was this massive explosion of young people wanting to go into global health, right? And that's what I mean. And they want their boss to give them a job where they're working in a little, which is fine. Like it's interesting, but that has largely been decimated by changes that have happened because of the administration and loss of funding and loss of programs. And so now people just want a job, right? They just want to be somewhere secure and know that they, you know, have money to live. So I think it's, you know, it switches back and forth, right, all the time.
Well, but when it's doing that, it's also, it sounds like even with that switch, that's looking at it from the lens of like someone from the US or, you know, a high income country going to a low middle income country. But the opposite way of the lack of funding, the sort of I think I can say this, the turmoil, kind of the up and down that's happening globally, not just with this administration, but, you know, other administrations overseas as well. That adds another layer of complexity, I think, to those pathologists and the work that they were already doing on scarce resources, right? And so that that compounds that burnout sense for those pathologists. So it's interesting that you talk about this way.
Absolutely. And you know, when we're in a period of lots of money flowing into low middle income countries where we have good academic partnership programs where people are being trained locally and have opportunities to go abroad and train and come back home and be leaders in their hospitals, which that was basically the 2000s to 2010s for me into 2016. You know, that was a great period of time. Lots of people were learned, et cetera. But as soon as this flip switched, the slip and suddenly there was the funding was cut off. Now all those people want to come to the US or Europe and they have the skills to do it. I mean, they're super smart people, and they have the skills to do it. But now there's challenges with immigration and there's not enough visas and not enough people to be able to go. So it's doubly bad, right? As you said, it's the resource constraint of what they were trying to do, but also they can't leave when they're highly qualified and could do that. And, you know, it's brain drain. I'm not going to support that brain drain is a good thing or it's a bad thing, but people have children, people have families, they need money. Yeah. And if they're highly qualified and we have a scarcity of pathologists in the US and we don't have enough to fill, I don't understand why it wouldn't be a reasonable thing to do. The other piece of this in a future state, not in our current state, is that when we have digital pathology to a point where we can harmonize and globalize the ability to share cases with any pathologist in the world, we will suddenly have an enormous workforce of people globally that can look at any case and crowdgnostically give you a diagnosis, you know, almost in a gamification approach where you know, 98% of everyone who looked at this said it was a, you know, rhabdomyosarcoma, right? So you know it's a rhabdomyosarcoma, even if you've never seen one before. So I think that opportunity is out there and something I'm very hopeful for. It happens right now on Twitter, or I guess it's called X now, where people will post a case to get people's feedback and they'll get the answer within minutes because people in every time zone are looking at these cases. And then there are quite a few famous pathologists, influencers who post cases all the time that people respond to and other people will post their cases. So if we think about that, but in a harmonized, globalized way, through a platform that's official, you can imagine how much you could reduce costs and improve turnaround time and accuracy in any setting by doing it that way.
It's not funny, but it's ironic how the need for sort of the personal relationships will become even greater. Because I think what I hear you saying is like that mentor-mentee, you know, I respond to you, you post a case, I respond to you, is going to become even more greater. Even when digital pathology helps to harmonize this issue. So that's just the irony to me. That's what kind of sticks out is like how important interpersonal relationships are going to be when that.
Yeah. And again, that group of people under 40, and again, I'm using it as an arbitrary term, and I don't want someone to stick me to like, oh, that's not the right generational gap. I don't care. My point is younger people younger than me, they have a very strong social connectivity, right? And it's because they grew up on social media, but they grew up on social media as that being a normal part of life and that being a positive thing, right? And so they seek more and more of that interaction, you know? And you've got the extreme ends, right? You've got the influencers who want everyone to follow everything they do all the time and don't really care what people say. And that's fine, but that's not so helpful. But then you also have the mass followers who follow every possible thing and they're building their educational knowledge. They're building their resources of people they can work with, et cetera. And so they have lots and lots of fingers and a lot of pies to know what's going on. And they're very clever and have a tendency to be able to excel at whatever they're doing because they have that connectivity to some people. And then the rest of us are somewhere in between, I guess.
Yeah. So to wrap us up here, if you could give the gift of wellness to a global pathologist, something that would actually stick and that could change the culture, what would it be?
I mean, it's so many things, unfortunately. And this is something I think about all the time. So it's really hard to like narrow it down to one thing. On the simple side, being appreciated and that knowing that when they make a diagnosis, a patient's life is being saved. I think that kind of constant reinforcement of why we're here and why we do this, which is what we get every day in the US. I think people don't often get it in low middle income countries. And so that's something simple that we can all do is help them feel appreciated and that know that they are helping patients do that. On the complex side, it sounds really cliche, but I'll just say it's money, right? It's just funding. There has to be a way to create monetize a way that is beneficial to patients and beneficial to the lab and the pathologists and the surgeons and the oncologists, et cetera, in a global setting. And I could spend an hour talking about why it's not currently that way, but I think that ultimately the gift I would give is that I would give a system that is recapitulating, mm-hmm. that pays for itself, that no patient is left behind, and that pathologists really feel supported and able to do exactly what they're asked to do for every patient and not rationing what they have.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to today's guest, Dr. Milner. You can learn more in this episode's show notes. This podcast is brought to you by the CAP Foundation, dedicated to expanding access to care through pathology. To learn more about the CAP Foundation and the programs it supports, visit foundation.cap.org. You can also support the foundation by shopping at the new store, where every purchase helps advance our mission. Be sure to follow us on social media and like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Until next time, my friends, I'm Joanna, and thank you for listening.